as a hacker, you need to sort of make assumptions about what the code is and guess. But then if your assumptions are wrong, you fail. And with a debugger, you can instantly verify that an assumption is indeed correct or incorrect and quickly find the path for the answer. It's an amazing tool.
Welcome to Mangtas Nation Season 2. This season is all about tech of the future. We'll be sharing real-world experiences and featuring astounding guests to help guide you in your tech journey. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
I'm ready.
I'm ready.
I'm ready.
The show starts right now.
Hello, everyone. This is Jackie Demenk, together with Waudo Delvare, and welcome to the Mangtas Nation podcast. Today, we have the pleasure of interviewing a hands-on successful software engineer, developer advocate, architect, entrepreneur, and author. He has been leading teams and delivering various solutions across tech stacks and deployment models. He is also a major open source contributor who has led key global projects around the world in his 30-year professional career. Listeners, let us all welcome the co-founder of Codename One and the author of Practical Debugging at Scale, Shai Almog. Hey, Shai, thank you for being with us here today and welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for that great introduction.
You're welcome. Now, we're very thrilled to have you here with us today and share your insights to our listeners, especially your experience. But before we dive deeper into the conversation, can you start by telling us a bit about yourself, Shai, please?
So, as you said, I founded a couple of companies, wrote a few books, including this, and actually I'm 50% through a new one that will come out middle of the year. I did formed quite a few open source projects and a couple of big ones as well as part of that. I worked as a consultant for well over a decade, so worked with over 100 companies. And, you know, when you say consultant, people have this sort of vague thing, because it is a vague profession. But a technical consultant sort of needs to walk into a company and prove himself and not annoy the engineers who want to prove themselves that, like, sort of why do we need that really expensive engineer telling us what to do? So it's a very technically grueling sort of work that propelled my level of experience over the years.
I have a quick question before we go deeper into your consulting and all that, right? How about before all of that, Shai? Where were you born? How did you decide to step into this, you know, exciting environment of tech?
So that's a great question. So I was born in Israel and raised here. My accent's a bit weird because my mother immigrated and I only spoke English initially. But then I stopped because I learned everyone else was speaking Hebrew. So that's what I ended up with. And as a kid at 5, I got my first Sinclair Spectrum computer, which was, I think, 7980, something like that. And I just started writing programs with it because there were no games. They didn't buy the cassette deck. So I started programming in BASIC back then. And it was a really easy computer to work with, and it sort of got me started. And then I started working with Apple computers later on and building, trying to build games and learn that sort of stuff at a young age. And that sort of got me hooked. I later on moved to run a BBS and do all sorts of things and got my first job at 16, building computer games. And that sort of from then on, you know, constantly moving between companies and building stuff. So,
We'll probably, go ahead, Jackie. I was going to say, we'll probably put like a link to a wiki of the Sinclair Spectrum computer in the show notes for the listeners who don't know what that is. Maybe also a link to like a Walkman and a cassette. What those are. Like, you know, back in the day, feeling
that's my childhood. Without the, you know, the weird monsters, that's pretty much, you know, yeah.
So if you are a technical consultant for 100 clients, right, or more, right, what do you come in for? Now, okay, you built all of this, you built this experience. Give a little bit more color around the type of clients that you would go through and what you would do for them, right?
So there were lots of types of clients. Some of them just needed people to develop things that they didn't have resources. So I employed quite a few developers, which I trained personally to get them, give them the experience that they needed. And I focused on Java, because you need a certain vertical that you're comfortable with. And I started using Java at its first beta and really fell in love with the language, because up until then I was very deep in C++ and I thought I loved it, but it wasn't the real thing, if you get what I mean. And when Java came out, it was so much better. And I decided that it's the hot new thing, and I focused on that. And companies who were relatively new to that or didn't have the same level of experience started contacting me. And when they ran into a problem with the JVM or with various things that they weren't able to solve, everything from garbage collecting taking too long to is it possible to do this on a phone with a Java phone back then, or and I'd find the appropriate workaround for that, or if something just didn't work correctly, performance was bad. A bank, for instance, had a company that was contracting for a bank had a problem where they had a process that they guaranteed in contract that it will take 1 second and it took 7 minutes. So I came over and ran a profiler. This was literally the only thing I did. It took me a day to run the profiler because it was difficult. Their system was very complex. But I found the problem, the main problem, and reduced the time from 7 minutes to 7 seconds in a day. And it was worth their expense to pay me that really excessive amount of money that I asked for to get that to that point. And this is, by the way, an example of using a debugging tool or a profiler to sort of make money as a consultant. And this is something I did quite often. I leveraged my experience to give them the extra benefit. And this sort of created a reputation that cascaded. I never did any marketing or anything like that. I didn't have any sales department. I just, through word of mouth and through connections with friends and a social network, I sort of was able to get one customer after another after another. And these customers often took me to additional customers as part of their job.
That's the best way to grow, right?
Yeah, organically, word of mouth. So before we talk a little bit about, you mentioned debugging, and I also want to hear much more about the companies you built, right? But I think there's something, like, there are a lot of tech listeners on this program as well. Why did you feel Java was so much better than C++? Why did you fall in love with it? And how long did you stick with it? Or are you still with it, right?
I'm still with it.
Some technical details.
Deep with it. And still love it all these years, despite all of this time, despite the fact that it's aged, but actually it aged gracefully. One of the things in C++, I worked with it for years, and I loved its power. The fact that you can override everything, do everything, and the complexity, it drew me in a lot. But then I started working on large projects. And when I worked on large projects, really large projects, you start hitting the problem of C++, that you can read code and it doesn't do what it seems to be doing. You have A plus B. but the plus can be an operator that's overridden, and you might be reading it incorrectly because the wrong operator might be invoked, and things can behave rather differently than what you would expect. You spend lots of time start looking at compiler errors and sort of fighting the language to get the language to do what you would expect, and Java is much more deterministic. So when you go to large code bases and try to find something, and especially as a consultant, it's usually trivial. You look at a method and it does what it says it does. It doesn't have as many external implications that might cause things. And because of the JVM, the behavior is super consistent. I've spent a night trying to debug a problem of missing elements in C++ because only in release builds, because someone returned an object that was on the stack as a reference. And you're not allowed to do that in C++. And the thing is, it worked in the debug environment fine. But in production, when you did the release, it failed badly. And this was obviously a problem. In Java, this just isn't possible. Things like that don't happen. And I've learned to value the simplicity and the elegance that comes with it. And the object-oriented model is stronger, simpler, and I think that's very valuable when you want to scale. I think the complexity needs to be in the API, in the additional functionality, and not in the language itself. The language should be fluid and easy.
Excellent. Love that summary. And I think there are a lot of people that can relate to this. So tell us a little bit more about the businesses that you started and what you do exactly today.
So I've built a few things in my years because my parents were also not entrepreneurs, but ran a small business and everything, and it's sort of the thing. But the big business that I built first was the consulting company. And it was just a matter of I worked at a company and I decided I'll quit and just start consulting. And I didn't really know what I was doing. But I was lucky to do it in the 90s, and the 90s in Israel was sort of startup nation thing, and it was insane. So many startups. I consulted, I think, to seven separate startups that did instant messaging, because I don't know if you know, ICQ came from Israel. It was the first big chat messaging platform. And it was sold to AOL for $300 or so million, which sounds like peanuts today, but it was revolutionary. It's like four hippies sold the company to a major conglomerate for hundreds of millions, and it sort of created a local dream around here, and everyone started.
Yeah, I still remember ICQ.
Yeah.
We'll put a link to the show notes as well, and ICQ.
Yeah. So it's still big in Russia, by the way, if I understand correctly. I think it was bought there. But it sort of created an environment where I think just the fact that I was available and knew the current trending language was enough. And I just was able to get into lots of companies. And I also did a lot of early community work to sort of market myself, because I knew I would start a company. So years earlier, I started just participating in online forums and helping people without any motive, just to get my name out. And my name sort of became very Googleable. To this day, there's lots of Shai Elmogs in Israel. Lots of them. It's a very common name, surprisingly. But I dominate Google in English for my name completely. You know, the first 10 pages. And there's a CEO there. You can't find him. You know, there's... but it's important, obviously. And that ran for years. And I worked at Sun Microsystems as well as part of that. And lots of other companies. Sun Microsystems is a company that created Java. I did JVMs there and all sorts of things of that type. And during that time, I created a few things, including a large open source project. And later on, me and my best friend who worked at Sun at that time, we decided to leave and form Codename One, which is a company based on open source code that we initially built at Sun. And mm-hmm. and that's a second big company that I created within. And it's still running to this day. It lets developers build mobile applications in Java or Kotlin. And it's open source. And,
it's a tool. So basically, it's a platform or a tool where developers can come in and build, did you say, mobile applications? Yeah. On either Java or Kotlin. Yeah. Okay, cool.
Yeah, if you're familiar with Flutter, it does something similar. Just did it like 6 years before Flutter came around. 2012, we launched it. And it's lets you compile Java bytecode into native iOS code. We wrote a JVM for iOS for the ARM machines. And it compiles for Windows as well, UWP, all of that. It compiles to Android, which is easy because Android's already Java, so it works seamlessly. And it includes all the libraries you would need and everything to make it all seamless. It includes Macs in the cloud, so you don't need a Mac physically. You can just right-click a project and say, build a native application. It sends the information to the cloud and gets back a native application. And it includes all of the tools you would expect, integrations with the IDEs, with Maven, with GUI builders, CSS support, all sorts of things like that. Everything all in one, and it's all open source in the project.
Phenomenal. Now, beyond that, right, what you basically started companies, but you also wrote books, you mentioned. Tell us a little bit, how do you start writing a book and why?
So the first book, when I was at Sun, I wrote documentation, did a lot of blogging even before that. But one of the projects that I worked on needed documentation and started working with a tech writer over there to write it, because no one else had the English skills at my level to be able to actually create something coherent or close enough to coherence so an editor can improve it, because my writing isn't, mm-hmm. or at least wasn't, as great. And I've also written before that. I wrote articles about developing in Java for an online publication in the 90s. And they're still around. And knowing the level of my English writing skills before my current level, I'm so sorry for the editor who published them, because he probably had a lot of heavy lifting to do at fixing my writing back then. But practice makes perfect. When we started Codename One, I started blogging daily and just writing lots of things, because when you're building a platform of this magnitude, what you need is to teach people. And I did lots of videos. I did over 25 hours of video tutorials, and I did lots of writing and information. Eventually, it's sort of all the documentation ended up being about 1,000 pages printed. And that was just became a book as part of the documentation. The Codename One Developer Guide sort of happened just out of me writing everything that we did and explaining everything. And it sort of evolved organically. And once we published that, I started thinking about, maybe we need a bit better documentation about something that's more actionable. What do people want when they want to build applications? And that became my second book. I started it as a course on how to build an app like Uber, because that I noticed that lots of people were looking at building an app clone to Uber, and not necessarily building a real clone. But when we want to build a startup, we usually start with, I want to build X with Y. I want to build, say, Airbnb for monasteries or something like that. You know, there's even, I think, an online site that does these sort of Cards Against Humanity sort of mixes for how to build startups. So I thought we should pick the top clones that people want to build, the sort of templates that people want to start from. and go from there. And I created that course, and then I did the material for the course because I did the videos and everything. And I scripted the videos, and I looked at it, and I said, well, that's material for a book. So I wrote a book as well. And I talked with Manning about publishing it, and they accepted, and I went through the whole process of publishing with Manning. And it reached marketing. And apparently the acquisition editor and the marketing department weren't in sync about what the book would be. And eventually they decided to not publish it and return the rights to me. Although I did get to keep the initial, you know, the payment that they give it up front, the name. So anyway, I got to keep that, although...
Like a royalty payment, is it?
No, it wasn't. It's not royalties. No, you get something before the royalties as an author once you submit the entire book. Yep. And it comes off the royalties later on. Mm. Not for all books, by the way. In my current book, I didn't. But it's a matter of, you know, the contract with a specific company. So I just self-published it, which was very educational because I wanted to build a book visually that's similar to the Manning books. And they have amazing code listings. And I learned how to do that. I wrote a blog post about how I did all of the layouts there. It was a very educational process. I used tools that were not meant for desktop publishing. And they produced a pretty, I'd say, brilliant output that I haven't seen any technical books that reached that level of good looks, to say to myself, you know, to give myself a compliment there. But it is very good looking, and I published that, and it sold nicely. And to this day, Coding One has a relatively large amount of location based applications. And that sort of derived from that, I guess. And my current book is from A-Press, and they did finish the book through. And that the acquisition editor contacted me. And this time, you know, we made sure that we were on the same page. And since I developed the entire book with them, it was all completely synchronized. And it's just out now. Although, to be fair, that acquisition editor has since quit A-Press. I don't think it's me. He quit it after 27 years. But I don't think it's my fault. But it's kind of...
What did
you
do,
working with
the
guy, and then suddenly, you know, after 27 years, he quits. Yeah?
Maybe that was like, this is the final piece. I'm out. You know, it was good enough to say goodbye to a career. Like,
so you should have
quit while I'm ahead.
Yeah, exactly. So is that practical debugging at scale? Is that the book that you're referring to? Excellent. And so what are you trying to achieve with that? So before we go to the fourth, so like the practical debugging at scale, right? What's the general message?
So debugging is, I like to tell a story about, say 26, 27 years ago, I was, you know, already pretty experienced. I know everything. I'm a pretty cocky young developer, very sure of myself. I'm so brilliant. And I was working with a senior developer, and we're debugging together. And I know everything. And that guy starts doing all sorts of things in the debugger that sort of blew my mind. I didn't really realize that you could use the debugger in that way. And it kind of took me down a peg, a couple of pegs, because it's kind of the basic thing. We need to know that
it was a humbling experience.
Exactly. And it's humbling. And back then I didn't know how to be humbled properly. You know, this is something that I had to learn. So it was humiliating back then. You know, as an old person, I'm, you know, humbling's fine. You know, I don't care about anything.
Yeah.
But back then it was humiliating. But it was a great thing. I was lucky because I was exposed to the level of my ignorance. And, you know, wisdom is understanding the exact level of your own ignorance. And when I was exposed to that sort of void in my knowledge, that big hole, I quickly rushed to fill it up as much as I could. And the thing is, there's not that much material. There's lots of theoretical academic books about debugging, although they don't teach it in academia because you can't test it. So when you go to the university, they don't teach you how to debug. Most developers don't want to know how to debug because they treat it kind of like taking out the trash. They hold their nose and run to the door trying to throw it out, not smell anything. And the reason is, you want to get rid of the bug, and the whole process of getting rid of the bug, you sort of just want to get it over with. And this is something that's problematic, because I've spent days debugging some things. And all of us have, you know, spent sleepless nights chasing an issue. So, you know, there's surveys that say debugging takes up 60% of our time. I don't know. It sounds a bit one of those statistics that don't really necessarily, someone pulled it out of somewhere. But I know from experience that the only times I thought, well, maybe I picked the wrong profession, was either when I was sitting with someone who's truly brilliant at a level that I've never run into, or when I was debugging. These are the only two times where I felt this sort of, I hate saying the word imposter syndrome because it's so overused in the recent years, but these are the times where you feel so frustrated with yourself and so stupid that we need to improve that skill. It's something that's universal. And when I give talks about that, everyone understands what I'm talking about, because everyone feels stupid when they're debugging. It's humbling. And no book gives the full tools over there. There are maybe one or two books that talk about the debugger. And even then, don't go in depth and don't cover lots of the features there. And there's some overly academic books that are either somewhat out of date and also very abstract, that talk too much about the process, the theoretical process. And I talk about it, but the theory isn't that interesting. It's simple, and most of us use it already to some degree. So I wanted to create something that's more actionable, that takes you through the three parts. The first part is, what tools do we have? How do they work? And lots of things that people don't know about or have never given them that much thought. You know, like logging. Logging is precognitive debugging. It's writing down the things that you'd want to see when you're debugging later on. And people usually think about logging in the here and now and not in the future, and don't think about them in the correct way. So things like that, or the debugging in the IDE. Yesterday I gave a lecture, which I gave quite a few times, and people are always shocked by that lecture, because I talk about the IDE, that place where we as developers spend all of our time writing code. And I showed the debugger in the IDE and all sorts of features that are there, and lots of developers, pretty much everyone in the room, usually doesn't know. They don't know about lots of these features. And it's a shame, because they can make a huge, huge, huge difference in our time spent debugging. And that's just the first chapter. The book has 14 of them. As I said, the first part is about the tooling and the environment. The second part is about production and the cloud and the way of debugging that, observability, Kubernetes, all of that stuff. And the third part is about in action, how debugging, sort of real world stories, and how you can apply these ideas into the project. So how to debug something related to security, to find a security vulnerability, how to learn new code. The debugger is an amazing learning tool where you can study a complex project. As a consultant, you know, I'd come to a completely new project with hundreds of thousands or millions of lines of code. You can't read that. That isn't a book. No human being can. So as a hacker, you need to sort of make assumptions about what the code is and guess. But then if your assumptions are wrong, then you fail. And with a debugger, you can instantly verify that an assumption is indeed correct or incorrect, and quickly find the path for the answer. And people don't leverage that to just learn the code. They start reading it instead of experimenting with it. It's an amazing tool. And it's not the tool alone. There are auxiliary tools, things like strace and things like that, which are spectacular, that people don't leverage enough, which I hope to change.
So you say, I hear the practical, I hear the debugging, and I don't know if I'm 100%, the passion for sure. But when you say at scale, what are you referring to exactly?
So back in the day when we were starting with the internet, and keep in mind, some portion of my career was done before the internet was really much of a thing. And no Stack Overflow, no Google, no nothing. And actually, most of my career was without Stack Overflow, which was very different, I have to say. So Stack Overflow simplified lots of things, but it also made scaling more relevant, because now it's easier to build software, so software becomes bigger. The same thing is true with Kubernetes. So back in those days, we'd go to the server, kick it, and hear the hard drive spin. Yeah, that's observability. It's working. And today, you can't build any service without proper observability, without not necessarily even Kubernetes, but lots of servers, lots of regions, lots of different systems coming together, external services that you depend on, that depend further on other services. And it becomes... It's these things simplify some things, but make other things far more complex. So the possibilities that were opened through scaling essentially created a new form of complexity of scale that opens up issues that are much harder to debug. In the past, we used to have XA transactions, which meant you could literally run a transaction between two servers thanks to the XA protocol, which was one super complex thing that I always had troubles explaining when I was teaching these sort of things. But now we have eventual consistency, which is far more complex in some regards. It's supposed to be simpler. It's harder. And debugging issues in the midst of that is insane sometimes. So when we want to debug at those scales, we're faced with completely new types of issues, and that means working with not necessarily with the regular debugger that we use in the IDE, but rather with those external tools, observability tools of logging, tracing, and also developer observability tools and such. And that changes the equation completely, because when we talk debugging, we usually talk locally, or maybe remote debugging for some cases, but even then you can't remote debug a cluster. You can't remote debug microservices all over. So debugging at scale means production, because production is what matters. That's what we're building, basically. So if the system works perfectly locally but fails in production, then we failed. It doesn't matter that it works locally. We haven't succeeded. And that's the thing that matters, really, the scale, in today's world, that is.
Fascinating. You mentioned Stack Overflow, right? I can imagine your life, well, kind of, before Stack Overflow. I can't relate to it. But now we got ChatGPT. And now it's going to be the life before ChatGPT. Are you already, in my view, right? It's very early days, obviously, but what I have seen is shocking. How are you using these type of AI tools at all already?
So I play with them a bit. I'm actually not as happy as maybe because I ask too hard questions. So back in the day when I started, I I had this huge, tremendous library, and the skill that I needed was to remember that book X had in paragraphs and such page had this thing that was a solution, and it was a library filled with thousands of pages in each book, and just finding the right thing. And it was a game of memory and the ability to read really, really, really fast, which is a skill that I mastered in order to do that. And this sort of flipped. Now I don't need to remember anything and just sort of search. Sort of the same thing like using a GPS today. It sort of removed the need to have location awareness or how to navigate without it. So that game changed. I didn't have code completion back then. There were no IDEs during some of that time. So you learn to work with the things that you have at hand, and they improve and essentially promote bigger scale. So I think tools like Copilot and ChatGPT and all of those similar tools are essentially an extension of the code completion. They will make some template generation easier, and there's no doubt, but not that much easier, because today Stack Overflow has already made a lot of that data very available and very searchable. So it really revolutionized things. So this will make it even more easy than it was before. But I've ran into lots of cases where ChatGPT generates wrong answers and invalid answers and buggy answers. And the problem is that you'll spend more time debugging thanks to that. So it might increase productivity in some regards, but I think if you spend more time debugging later on or reviewing the code, some of that will be negated. So I'm not sure. I guess they will improve some of that, but the problem is garbage in, garbage out. So the more people use ChatGPT, the more it will parse that bad data, and the more it will generate bad data. So it will sort of, it's a problem because you can't really verify that the data is correct. And ChatGPT has one major flaw. It doesn't provide any references. Back in the 90s, I worked at a company that was an AI company, and I really loved working in AI, and sadly I has kind of left that field. I'm having thoughts about going back, but I don't know. Anyway, one of their tools was not a chat, but a classic AI system where you'd ask it a question and it would give you an answer similar to that. But the nice thing about it is that it was able to explain the answer. So if the answer didn't seem to make sense, it would actually explain the logic in human language back to you. And this is hugely valuable, and ChatGPT doesn't have that. And until it can actually give us references to what it's saying, then it's not that different from any idiot on the internet who says X is Y. I just today saw a chat that ChatGPT had on a social network with a person saying, how much is 5 plus 2? And it said 7, and then it says, my wife says 5 plus 2 is 8. So ChatGPT says, no, it's 7, she's wrong. So the guy says, no, my wife is always right. So he says, well, she's probably right about that. I'm sorry that I made that mistake. So, you know.
I saw that one.
Yeah. So
you're right, it's your wife, she's right.
Yeah.
Wives are always right.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly, but it went 3 levels deeper, Shai. It didn't want to give the right answer anymore. Or you said, "Wife, I'm out."
Yeah, but there were other.
No, but it's a good point. It's a valid point. Mm-hmm. It's a valid point, right? And it's a big part of AI, like the explainability of it all, right? And
yeah. And how given the complexity. I've been in the industry for quite a while, and in AI, and you know, I've been through all of the promises and everything, and. The problem isn't, there's lots of fields within AI that are very interesting, but the problem with the training system, with all the learning systems, has always been that you can't really explain how it got to that result. And it's harder to prove IP ownership and things like that. So it creates lots of problems. We need systems that provide, the reason we turn to computers and the things I personally want from computers is for them to be computers. I don't want the computer to be smart. I want it to be reliable. And when a computer drives a car for me, I want it to be very consistent. I don't want it to be creative. And the same is true for everything, most of the things that it does. And there's obviously points of interface where you need some creativity. OCR is a great example, where you want it to read things for you and you're willing to accept a level of errors that it gets there. But when it does something like write code for you, it becomes a bit of a problem. Can you trust that code? Can you trust the ownership, the IP of that code or of that text that it wrote? And this is a bit, lots of times I read stuff that it wrote and it seems very human. And I think, did it read it somewhere? Did some human actually write it first? And it sort of copied that verbatim, maybe making a few changes here and there. I can't know. And without it being able to audit itself, it's
got its challenges. I do agree with it, right? And I think it's going to be really tested, right? Because right now it's still limited, right? It's what's trained based on up to 2021 or something. I think there's going to be a massive cultural shift almost, where we're going to have these discussions and people are going to get away with a lot of content that's written by this, and we're going to ask very different questions than we ask in the Google era, right? It will be fascinating to follow it. Because I mean, the excitement that I see with everyone is phenomenal. Like, it's crazy. It's like, yeah, Google was a bit more gradual, I felt. I mean, you probably have seen several revolutions more than me, but yeah. This is just overnight. And everyone
I
is like,
it's very exciting. And I'm looking forward to it taking some of the role of Google away from it, because it's time. I think Google stagnated for a few decades by now and hasn't really improved since 2003 or so. And it's time for something new to come around and shake that up. The problem is that it's not really a replacement yet. I'd like it to be a replacement and to include more auditing. Hopefully, you know, the smart people there can find a solution for that, because I think it's probably doable to provide some form of accountability.
I think in the future, Shai might be already or planning to write practical debugging AI generated code, or any plans of writing that type of book, Shai?
Yeah, there's a joke about how AI debugging works by trial and error, and how that is so wrong in terms. I forgot how the joke goes, but it's. AI is impossible to debug because models fail very oddly in AI. In learning systems, you don't really know that it failed. You just start getting wrong answers and you don't really know why. And there's nothing to step over, or all of the regular tools we use during debugging sort of fail. I did some work with stream solution and all sorts of solutions like that are common in the AI field, and we can help in some stages there, but you know, basically it's just getting into the model data and moving stuff around until it works, and it's a problematic field.
Having said that, Shai, it's problematic, but having said that, there's not a single human on earth that can beat a chess AI anymore, right?
Yeah.
And they've come to a level, and I would almost argue, is this transferable to most other problems?
chess is usually, there's several AIs for chess that are based on training, and they indeed do learn to some degree. Lots of the chess systems are actually scheduling systems where they just search ahead for all possible moves and pick the right option, and that they can go much deeper and much further than a human being, even a grandmaster, in terms of the breadth of search and depth of the number of moves.
The brute
that
force.
Way they can actually...
Brute force, you mean?
Yeah. So in the case of, for instance, Deep Blue that beat Kasparov, the original big thing, as far as I know, and I didn't work on that, but I was told by an expert in AI back then, that it was a search system that just used heuristic searches to go through the tree of possible chess moves and pick the right move and beat that. You can obviously take the other approach of looking at previous games and training through that and hopefully getting something that's more a training-based system, and that would also win. But I think chess is a very structured environment, and in structured environments, AIs work well. In more free flow and larger environments where the variables are so wide, the constraints become too wide to define in the code for the training system. And then you might get results that don't make as much sense. So it's harder to control the quality of the results in those situations, because the winning and losing isn't as consistent either. So for instance, for ChatGPT, how do you create a sort of quality test suite for something like that? You can't run something through ChatGPT and hope to always get the same result back. And I'm just thinking about that. It's not something that you can really test at the level automatically that we normally test these things consistently as we retrain the model. And it's a problem.
It's a problem. Here's a question, Shai. In 10 years... when you write a code from scratch, how much of it do you think you'll write yourself?
So already I generate code when I create a project, and I don't use AI because there's templates and there's wizards that you start with. So it's already a case where I don't write. I think more will be generated. There's no question there. We'll see more and more tools that do autocomplete and generate stuff. I don't think it's that much of a big deal, because a relatively small amount of time is spent actually writing code of our daily lives. And most of that code would be relatively simple. Things like tests and things like that, it generates beautifully. And because usually tests have very clear parameters of unit tests specifically, have very clear parameters to how they should look. And you can easily infer them from the actual code if you wrote the code first. Obviously, not the case for TDD. But I'm not sure how much of a difference it will make in terms of the speed of work, because it will probably improve it a bit. But... today with Stack Overflow and things like that, it's so fast already. And I think the requirements will grow, so we won't feel that difference. It will sort of be taken away, right? It's like the improvements in Moore's Law and in terms of stronger computers sort of get lost, because we immediately find the uses for that at that extra capacity. The same will be true for our capacity as programmers to write code faster. So we won't notice it.
And back to your original point, the time that you'll spend on checking and debugging may negate what it ultimately produces, right? Which needs to be factored in. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, although I assume these models will improve over the years. I don't think they will be perfect as long as they don't change the way in which they work. Which is also a possibility. You know, lots of smart people are looking at the problem they might find solutions to those problems, probably will.
Well, for young engineers now, Shai, who are dreaming of becoming a consultant, like you are reaching the level that you've reached, what are some tips that you could give them to advance their careers?
So I'm not sure if consulting is the right way to start, because it's a challenging process, and you need luck in the consulting industry, because I was lucky to be at the right time and the right place with the right amount of ignorance about how it shouldn't possibly work in that way, to sort of just go gung-ho ahead and be lucky. But for most people, it doesn't work that way, and I'm not sure if that's the right way to start early on. Lots of developers, I think, would be better served by just going to a startup or something like that and gaining experience there, because this is a very high-stress, high-yield environment where young people can gain more experience quickly and learn how startups really work, how to build these things and gain that experience. After being in a couple of those startups, then consulting might become more practical, and usually where you start is at companies you worked at in the past and in your third circle of acquaintances. That means generally when I got jobs, it wasn't through my direct friends, because usually I know the direct friends and they don't market you as much and don't open up opportunities as much. I've had the most experience, and I've heard that from other people, with friends of friends and with people who I know and I'm connected to, but from a job that I did in the past or from school or from something like that. And they saw that I'm a consultant and know that I'm good at these sort of things, and they recommended me. And pretty much most of my jobs, I think with the exception of one or two engagements, I got this way, by a friend of a friend, a former customer, an employee at a company that I worked for, consulted for, not direct friends, not people I would hang out with or be, you know, close friends with. So the thing is to foster these sorts of relationships and build them over time, participate in the community. And back then we didn't have meetups and things like that, but today obviously there's lots of venues to go and meet people and engage and talk with, go to conferences and be active. I go to lots of these things, and it always feels like everyone is going, because I meet people constantly in these things. But the reality is that a vast majority of programmers don't even bother. They don't listen to podcasts. They don't go to conferences. They don't go to meetups. They don't really extend themselves beyond school and work. And that opens up an opportunity for the people willing to go that extra mile and both improve themselves and engage.
Fantastic tips. Thank you, Shai. And for startups or businesses interested in connecting with you, where can they best find you, or how can they best get in touch with you?
So I have a blog at debugagent.com, and I also have the Twitter handle debugagent.com, at debugagent, and also on YouTube, on Mastodon, and on LinkedIn. I'm Shai Alimog with an I. So...
And your books, those, where can they also find your books?
Everywhere where books are sold. Book Depository, Amazon, you name it. It's number one new release in the debugging section in Amazon. Just the other day, I got it.
Amazing. What a great start to the year. Thank you, Shai. Well, yeah. We hope to our listeners, we hope you enjoyed today's episode with Shai Almog. It was a pleasure to hear about your extensive experience, Shai, and your insights in the industry. Thank you. And well, for more information about Shai, we'll make sure to include it in the show notes of this episode. And don't forget to tune in next time for more engaging and informative discussions with industry leaders and experts. Once again, thank you, Shai. And this is Jackie DeMenk.
And Wouter Delbare.
And stay tuned for the next episode of Mangtas Nation.
Thank you for tuning in to Mangtas Nation. Mangtas, your curated marketplace for B2B outsourcing solutions. Follow our social media pages to know more about us. Sign up as a client or sign up as a vendor and be part of this global B2B marketplace. Join us at www.mangtas.com.